will we do with the drunken sailor? What will we do with the drunken sailor? What will we do with the drunken sailor early in the morning?
Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Sober, put him in a longboat till he's sober. Put him in a longboat till he's sober early in the morning. Way, hey, up your rises, way.
Touchstone Pictures presents...
Here's how a harem girl dances. Okay, well, thank you for that. Whatever that was.
Cabin Boy.
They'll come in.
It's the story of a boy and his love affair with the sea.
This moron got on the wrong boat.
He never dreamed where the winds of fortune would blow him. Where the spirit of adventure would hurl him. Or where the hands of fate...
Come on over here, honey.
...would grab him.
These pipes are clean!
Touchstone Pictures presents...
What happened to you?
Well, let's just say I've finally shed my feminine side.
Chris Elliott.
So this is what you guys do for fun? Humiliate an imbecile?
Cabin Boy.
Thank you, fellow crewmates. I'm off. And when I return, I shall be a cabin man.
Rated PG-13. Now playing at a theater near you. Check newspaper for showtime.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Rob St. Mary, and joining me is the trusty navigator, of course, Mr. Mike White.
Ahoy, ahoy.
And joining us for another voyage on the SS Projection Booth, special guest co-host, Mike Sullivan.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, ahoy, mateys. On this episode, we're taking a look at Adam Resnick's 1994 absurdist comedy, Cabin Boy, starring Chris Elliott as a snobbish fancy lad, Nathaniel Mayweather, who takes a few wrong turns, ends up taking the wrong boat, and heads out on the high seas with a bunch of salty dogs aboard the Filthy Whore. The film also features an all-star cast of character actors and comedians, including Brian James, James Gammon, Brian Doyle Murray, Andy Richter, David Letterman, Melora Walters, Alfred Molina, and Ricky Lake, if you look fast enough. Cabin Boy also has a lot of Chris Elliott's humor, as you would expect, since he's starring in it, and you either love him or you hate him, usually, based on his humor, and the critics are rather savage to this film. But as our guest, Mr. Sullivan, I want to know, when did you first see Cabin Boy, and what are your thoughts then and now?
The first time I saw Chris Elliott was on Get a Life, and I was about... like 11 or 12, and I'm just going to be honest, he scared me. Like, I didn't really understand what his deal was. He was like a dick to people. He was kind of crazy, and I just would watch Get a Life, but it would scare me. I didn't understand it. And I didn't really turn around on it until I started watching the second season more and more, and it was like, oh, okay, I get it. Finally, I get it. This is really funny. It's just, like, very surreal. It's very weird. You know, whatever. It's different. I like it. And eventually, I didn't see Cabin Boy when I was in theaters, but I was, like, very excited about it. And I think it was on my birthday. My parents got, they rented the movie. And I watched it with my parents, and I just remember my parents just hating it. Especially in the beginning where he's like a jerk to everybody, you know, in that school. And he brutally mocks that guy in the beginning with the hat, you know. And I just remember them hating it pieces, and I just remember loving everything about it. And I never got to see it in theaters. It was after the fact on VHS, and you know, from that point on, that's basically what made me just like a hardcore Chris Elliott fan was Cabin Boy.
What about you, Mike? The other Mike.
The other Mike Meat. I saw this one. I think the first time was on DVD, and I'm trying to remember because I'm pretty sure my wife bought it for me. It was one of those like in the cheap bin at Walmart. I could have sworn that I saw it before that, but for sure I got a copy on DVD and watched it. And I said, you know, that really wasn't that bad because as you had mentioned, Rob, it was just savaged by the critics. Not only Mike Sullivan's parents hated this movie, but so many other people just hated this. It was like worse than cancer. People just hated this movie so much. And I don't know, I liked Chris Elliott from when I saw him in things like the David Letterman show. Rob, you posted something on our Facebook invite for this where it was like George Takei talking about, you know, like this whole robot fight that was taking place on the late night show and everything. And that was one of my first exposures to Chris Elliott. And that was where I really kind of fell in love with him.
February 12th, 1982. New York City. A celebrity-studded crowd turns out for the premiere of a new performer on the popular television show Late Night. This night, they will witness a miracle. Join us now as we go behind the scenes and experience together the magic and the mystery of Chris Elliott, the television miracle.
And then after that, you know, I would catch him on things like The Action Family and FDR, One Man Show, and really had a lot of respect for him. So when Cabin Boy came out, I remember the commercials and I said, boy, that looks kind of dumb, but kind of funny at the same time. And I don't know, for me, that's kind of sums up what I like about Chris Elliott's humor is there's that level of absurdity, but also this kind of really acerbic wit going on at the same time.
Well, someone, I think it was Penelope Spheeris, she once described Mike Myers' comedy as smart, stupid comedy, but I think that applies more to Chris Elliott than it does to Mike Myers. You know, I think that's his style, that smart, stupid style.
I would say even more than that, it's very absurdist. There's these, you know, non sequiturs and weird references, and it's like you, I got into him originally on Get a Life, and went back eventually and saw some of the Letterman stuff. I don't remember exactly when I saw Cabin Boy. It must have been on VHS because I don't remember going to the theater to see it. But it's always been one of those that I put in and really enjoy. And I can understand why people don't like it. I'm not stupid when it comes to Chris Elliott's humor because you either get his humor or you don't. There really is kind of no middle ground when it comes to the stuff he was doing on Letterman and Get a Life and even this. And I think it's very important, you know, moving forward in terms of what we talk about with comedy the way it is today. I think comedy the way it is today owes a big debt to Chris Elliott, but we'll talk about more of that later. So the plot, as I summed it up in the beginning, you know, it's pretty simple. It's kind of a riff on the you know, rich kid who ends up with the wrong pack of people. And in this case, he ends up on a boat. And this is the thing I thought was really interesting about the film when I got a chance to rewatch it, because it'd been about a year or so since I saw it and really, you know, take a look at it, is the film is so anachronistic in terms of its time. When it opens at the finishing school, like you were talking about, Mike, it almost seems like it's going to be this like 1700s, 1800s kind of era. But then pretty soon he gets picked up by a limo. So there's all of this odd sort of every time and no time kind of thing.
I don't know if you guys have ever seen the film Captain's Courageous, but it seems like it's kind of a really, really twisted look at Captain's Courageous, where it's kind of this kid who ends up with this crew of, you know, salty sea merchants and stuff, and Spencer Tracy takes care of them, and there's a really young John Carradine, which is kind of bizarre to see John Carradine so young. But it's like Chris Elliott is like this man child instead of just this, you know, bratty kid who goes on this sea adventure. He's so rude. And he's I think what I like about Chris Elliott is that he's not afraid to make you feel uncomfortable and make you kind of dislike him quite a bit as you watch it. And you kind of admire him for the way that he's making, you know, he's pushing your buttons a little bit.
What I like about that is that he isn't the only man child in the film. That's apparently like a school for man children. Because in the beginning, yeah, it's all men that are like in their early 30s. And I mean, there's like so much in that movie that it rewards you with like repeat viewings, because there's like so many things you lose, you don't catch the first time, and that's another reason I really like that movie. It grows with you. It's a film that really grows with you.
That choir that opens up and he's panning, you know, across the choir and they're singing the song, and eventually they get over to Chris and he's out of tune, and he's the only one with facial hair. Everyone else is all clean shaven, but he's got, you know, the full beard going on. And then they're wearing, you know, they got these wigs and all this stuff. And like I said, the design is really kind of a mishmash. There's all these kind of like little visual jokes in the background, especially when we talk about the Letterman scene. I thought it was hilarious. If you look over his shoulder, there's a fallout shelter sign and also a public notary sign. I mean, going through this film is almost like reading, you know, like those parodies they used to do in Mad Magazine when you were a kid of movies.
Yeah,
totally is. Yeah,
I never noticed the fallout sign. That's wow. I didn't notice that. And there's a notary sign too. I didn't notice that.
You, old man. Look, I am in desperate need of assistance.
Well. What's on your mind, little girl?
I realize that you are most likely the product of lower class inbreeding, but perhaps you could help me.
Oh gosh, I certainly hope so.
I have been wandering this dreary village in hopes of finding the Queen Catherine. You wouldn't have any idea where she might be docked, would you?
You know what you are? You're one of those little, fancy lads, aren't you? Boy, you're cute.
Okay.
Gosh, what a sweet little outfit. Is it your little spring outfit?
No.
You couldn't be cuter. You're so adorable. Oh, my. You know, you remind me of my niece Sally. Lovely girl. She's a dietitian. Hey, would you like to buy a monkey?
How long after Cabin Boy was out did Letterman host the Oscars? Because it couldn't have been too much later after that.
It wasn't, because I think it had to be for that year, you know, because I don't think they would have touched upon it otherwise.
Right, which was another just like major disaster. I loved when Letterman was on the Oscars, and I didn't see why people were just slamming him so much. I know that's kind of the thing to do, is to slam the person that hosts the Oscars, other than Billy Crystal, who seems to be like untouchable or something.
Yeah, why is that? He's just terrible. And yeah, I always thought Letterman got a bad deal with that, because he wasn't bad. What was the only really cringe inducing moment? That Oprah Uma thing.
Oprah. Uma. Uma. Oprah. I feel much better. Have you kids met Keanu?
Otherwise, I was fine. And then when he came back during, I think, one of the other Billy Crystal hosted things, and he's flying the plane from the English Patient going, "Introduce Oprah to Uma," you know. It's like, at least he's got the wherewithal to like parody himself, you know, while he's doing that. But that was hilarious when he was on the Oscars and did the whole auditions for the "You Want to Buy a Monkey" line. I love that.
But you know, as with all great work, I was not the first or only choice. Here now, take a look at some of my fellow actors who auditioned for this plum role.
Would you like to buy a monkey?
Would you like to buy a monkey?
I can do one bigger.
Want to buy a donkey?
A monkey.
I'm confused. I thought I was playing the monkey.
What's the matter? You don't like monkeys?
I like monkey. You like monkey?
Listen here. I'm not going to ask you again. I'm going to ask you one more time. You want to buy the monkey or not?
Huh? And I can do it in German or anything.
I want you to buy this monkey.
Could you clear my eye line, please, back there? Could everybody get out of my eye line? Thank you.
Would you like to buy a monkey?
Mexican monkey, happy.
Hey, mister, wanna buy a monkey?
Would you like to buy a monkey?
You want to buy a monkey?
Would you like to buy a monkey?
Monkey waiting for a phone call.
Monkey!
Monkey after a big meal.
You buy the monkey! You big mama, look, what's the matter with you, huh? I'm going to smack you upside the head.
Which Resnick directed.
That's right.
Yeah.
He directed that Resnick, the Oscar bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Too good. Sorry, Rob, have we taken you completely off course?
No, not at all.
Okay.
We are on course, and we're heading towards Hell's Bucket.
Well, the engine's flooded, the mizzen mast is down, and we got a crack in the midsection that's drawing water. One! Yeah. We got any options here, gentlemen?
Well, the only thing to do, as far as I can tell, is find a safe harbor and fix the boat.
Well, as you all know, there's only one island in Hell's Bucket, and I, for one, am not crazy about landing there.
Yeah, well, I ain't crazy about sitting on a boat till she sinks and we wind up flounder shit.
Yeah, those flounders are bloodthirsty bastards.
You're right. Not only are there the other man children at the school, but then you... One of the best man children in the film is this kind of, like, retarded Andy Richter character.
Sorry, but I ain't supposed to talk to nobody while I'm on watch. Captain Graybar says I got the attention span of a circus monkey.
Yes, well, I don't think your Captain Graybar is qualified to cast aspersions on the character of others.
Sorry, I don't speak Spanish.
That was my first time seeing Andy Richter, because I think this was before Conan went on the air, or short. It was right around the time that Conan went on the air, because I remember watching that in college.
It was right around the time, I remember that. It was right around the time that Conan came on,
And Richter, God, he looks like a baby in this compared to, you know, now when he rules the world. He rules the universe.
I think he literally looks like a baby in that. You're right. He really does look like a baby. Yeah.
Do you feel kind of sorry for him because he is so dim-witted? And then it's almost like Chris Elliott's Nathaniel Mayweather comes on the boat and kind of takes over the role of what Andy Richter was doing.
Yeah.
The other cameos in the film and various actors are really interesting. I mean, there's some that if you blink really fast, you'll kind of miss them. One that I really appreciate because I've always loved his stuff, especially getting to know him from Boogie Nights Forward, was Alfred Molina. And he only has like two lines in the film, and he plays the professor at the finishing school. And I think that's actually his real British accent.
Nathaniel! You may sit down, Lance. It is unfair to ask you to continue in the presence of this cackling baboon.
Somebody's daddy's missing a leg.
Nathaniel, since you seem so anxious to interrupt the proceedings with your usual infantile babble, kindly step forward and give us your presentation.
It would be my pleasure, my dear underpaid professor.
Yeah, I was super surprised when he showed up. I was like, really? I forgot that he was in that at all.
I didn't even realize he was in the movie until like years after. And the only reason I knew about it is because when Chris Elliott was on The Best Show, he mentioned Alfred Molina in the film. I'm like, is Alfred Molina in the film? And sure enough, in the beginning, yeah, he's in it, which is the most shocking appearance in the movie, is Molina.
I was very happy to see Brian Doyle Murray show up as Skunk.
You meaning to imply that this is not the Queen Catherine?
Uh-uh.
And you're not its well-trained crew here to cater to my every whim?
Nope.
Kid, we're just here to catch fish and stink.
Mostly the latter.
And though, while I was watching the movie, I kept thinking, this is kind of like a live-action version of SpongeBob SquarePants, because I was thinking of him doing the voice for the Flying Dutchman character.
You bet your lily-white livers I'm the Flying Dutchman. And I'll let you in on a little secret. I'm going to steal your soul.
There were some times where I kept like thinking, like, you know, like some of the animation and some of the graphics and the colors and everything, it just really felt like you could almost take SpongeBob and kind of meld him into this movie. And I don't think that would be kind of inappropriate at all.
That works really well. I never even considered that. But that, yeah, it has the accordion music in it. Like, Chris Elliott could double as SpongeBob. It works perfectly. I mean, I always considered it to be the unofficial Get a Life movie. You know, I because, like, Brian Doyle's Murray's in it, and, like, the heavyset guy that was in the construction what was his name again? I can never remember. He was in the construction worker episode. He's, like, the heavyset guy with the beard. Yeah, the captain. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I don't remember what the guy's name is.
Yeah, I always, like, flies out of my brain. I can never remember it. But because those guys, like, pop up in it, you know, I always consider that to be, like, an unofficial Get a Life movie, you know? But, yeah, the SpongeBob thing works, too. You know, I never considered that. That worked really well.
And I agree with you on that, too, because, obviously, his dad is in here who plays his dad
at the
end of the film. And Brian Doyle Murray, in the second season of Get a Life, Chris moves out of his parents' house and moves in with Gus, Brian Doyle Murray, and there's all of this stuff between them. And it's almost like if he was the captain, I would say, okay, a little bit more because he has more interactions that way. But still, it was great, you know, because Brian Doyle Murray is great. I mean, most people would remember him from, like, Caddyshack.
Right, or any other movie that his brother is in, pretty much.
Yeah, but I think he's funny on his own accord. I don't think just because he happens to be Bill Murray's brother that in some way, lessens him. I think he's really good.
No, he is hilarious. I mean, he's one of my favorite, he does one of my favorite characters in Seinfeld, where he's the guy that drives the Yoo-Hoo truck.
I never saw that episode. I didn't even know he was on Seinfeld.
No, yeah, he was in the one with Bubble Boy.
Oh, yeah, he was. That's right. Yeah, I forgot. I always just remember Bubble Boy. I forget about Bill Murray. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yep.
Just as the film goes on, you have all of these people like Brian Doyle Murray, like Alfred Molina. I guess Ricky Lake is in it, and she plays the figurehead on the boat. She doesn't have a lot to do. It's kind of hard to tell that it's her because she's kind of made up so well. And then another connection to the world of Paul Thomas Anderson and Boogie Nights, Mike, Melora Walters as the swimmer that Nathaniel pulls out of the ocean, and she gets upset with him and all that stuff within the film. She's also in Boogie Nights. So there's like this great sort of cast of character actors. And also, of course, how can we forget the Shark Man?
Oh yeah. I was so happy to see Russ Tamblyn show up in this, and he doesn't even have a line at all. Does he?
I don't think so. No, no,
no, no. He just kind of, you know, waves and winks, and that's about it.
Smiles.
Goodbye, sweet Chalky. I shan't forget you. Half man, half shark equals one complete gentleman.
And this was, I was familiar with Russ Tamblyn at this time to tie into an episode from a couple weeks ago because he was playing Dr. Jacoby in Twin Peaks just a few years before this. So it was good to see him show up again. And that was one of the areas where you really kind of see some of the, I don't know, I don't want to say cheapness because it just kind of points itself out to you a little bit, like the seam on his suit, you know, just looks so obvious. And there were so many times in the movie where it's just like, you kind of see those, you know, background things that you were talking about, Rob, where it's just like, you know, you can see the seam and the sky and stuff. And it's just like, I know that we'll hear a little bit more from Adam and Chris later when they talk about it. But for me, it kind of makes the movie that you see these kind of quote unquote mistakes, you know, it kind of adds to the overall flavor of the film.
It's charming. I mean, it's not, I don't think it's on the level of like, you know, Garth Marenghi where it's intentional. It's just, I don't think they had a big budget, but I think it just, it adds to the charm, and it's not like knowing. It's not knowing. It's not obnoxious. And that's what I like about that.
Right. It's not like it's in your face or they go up to, you know, something that's supposed to be 50 pounds and they pick it up with their finger or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think that that's part of it. I mean, this is the thing that I've often talked to people about when it comes to cult film, in that the reason why people like those 1950s films that are kind of cheesy is that it buys in completely. It doesn't have this, you know, wink, wink, you know, hit you with the elbow kind of thing. It's really trying. And I think that's the thing with Cabin Boy that works for me is, yes, it's a backdrop. Yes, there's certain things that aren't perfect, but it's not using it to go nudge, nudge, wink, wink. It's trying the best it can within the universe that it's created. And the universe is really, like I said, it's really kind of Mad Magazine. It's really kind of comic book. And especially all of the various monsters that you get throughout the film once they get into the Hell's Bucket scene.
I love the stop motion stuff that they're doing in here. Like the abominable snowman kind of thing, the glacier monster, the flying cupcake when Chris Elliott is out on the raft back there, you know, just those are so cheesy and just don't fit right with stuff, but I like it because of that.
And then you have the woman on the island who has this sort of Hindu goddess kind of multiple arms thing. And the one that I really liked also that's kind of funny is Mike Starr, character actor who you know by face, is this giant used car salesman looking guy who comes after him because, of course, he's married to the Hindu goddess woman who lives in the cave and takes care of the needs of all the lonely sailors.
You don't know how much in love I am with Anne Magnuson, just the movies that she's been in, the music that she's done and everything, and just, you know, she's so gorgeous, and seeing her show up in that role and just that whole, like, where she's trying to ask him questions that he has no idea how to answer, trying to do this whole riddles of the Sphinx kind of stuff. And she just wants to get laid after a while. It's just like, yeah, whatever, kid. You know, ask him all these incredibly difficult things.
How does the moon greet her daughters?
Well, if she's a refined lady, and I'm sure she is, she probably greets her young lassies with a gift of some sort. Maybe a box of peppermints or some hair care products, and then, you know, it's off to the mall and lunch. Have fun, girls. Bye-bye. That sort of thing.
And you're right. Mike Starr, I love that guy. Whenever he shows up and stuff, it's just like, oh, hey, Mike Starr. I haven't gotten to the point where Andrea actually knows who it is when I'm talking about him. And I'll be like, well, Mike Starr, he was in Goodfellas and this and that and the other thing. It's like, no, I still don't know who you are. Well, it's that guy. It's that tall, like lumpy guy right there.
He's the guy that the guys in Dumb and Dumber annoy. He's the guy who plays George Weiss, the film producer, and Ed Wood, which would have been around the same time as this, you know. And in this, it's great because, like I said, he looks kind of like a used car salesman or something. And I just love that he has this giant pocket protector, which Nathaniel, Chris Elliott's character, uses as like a raft to get back over to the boat after he slays the giant.
I like the way that Mike plays the character. He's a guy that clearly made a lot of bad choices in his life, and you know, he's not happy about, you know, working in the electronics store, but he's making a go of it anyway. I liked how he has like this sort of like this soiled dignity to his character. I always liked the way he played that.
Was business brisk?
This, not really. I sold one electric toothbrush to a flying leprechaun.
Well, don't be discouraged, dear. I'm sure things will pick up once word of mouth gets out.
Who am I kidding? It's a stupid idea to open up a houseware store on this island. I mean, I might as well just go back to devouring wild boar and sleeping on a beach all day.
Stop talking like that.
Yeah, it's like he's just trying to get ahead, you know, trying to put his nose to the grindstone and lead an honest life. For some reason, with this one, with this scene, I was reminded a lot of Time Bandits. And I know that, I guess it was just like that whole idea of like being on the boat and you got the giant underneath and then you got the lady from Soap up above and everything and her husband with the bad back. But yeah, for some reason, I was thinking that this kind of works in that universe as well. So I guess while I was watching Cabin Boy, needless to say, I kept thinking of other things that would kind of fit with this, like maybe like the perfect triple or quadruple feature.
It's funny that you brought up other sources, like you were talking about Captain's Courageous and things like that. For some reason, during this like battle with the giant kind of thing, and I know that it's not necessarily in that story, but it kind of reminded me in a way of like Gulliver's Travels kind of thing. Like this guy going through these various like worlds and different things and especially him like fighting this giant. So I just, you know, and like there's a lot of like little fables kind of things that are brought in here and you know, like you were talking about the stop motion. It's very, you know, Ray Harryhausen, which I absolutely love.
Yeah, in that fight with the giant did remind me a few times of the Ray Harryhausen stuff, I guess, especially with like the tiny Chris Elliott figure and stuff when he's holding them in his hand and all those kind of things reminded me of that quite a bit.
That's like one thing. I know like you were talking about this earlier, Rob, about, I can call you Rob, right? That's fine.
No.
Oh, okay. Robert.
No. It's Rob.
Okay. You were talking about this earlier about, you know, people not being like turning on the comedy, and I can understand that. I get that. You know, he's not for everybody, you know. But there's aspects of the movie that are so charming. Like, you know, like you said, the stop motion animation, like the weird, like subversions of like, you know, the sort of like, Harryhausen type plots. And that's something I even like with critics. It's like, you know, as like unhip critics can be about certain elements of comedy. I'm surprised he didn't say, well, hey, look, you know, look, I didn't really care for the comedy, but, you know, there's certain aspects in that, you know, like the, you know, the ice monster and this and that. That's like, those are elements of film that I can't see people not being charmed by. I can't see people just saying, okay, fine, I don't like the comedy, but I like the fantastic elements. That's something that surprises me, that doesn't grab people.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Elliot that just pushed people away, or was it that people didn't get this whole anachronism kind of thing? I mean, the movie's produced by Tim Burton, who was kind of like, you know, I don't know, I don't want to say famous for his anachronisms, but that was kind of the thing. Like when you went to see Edward Scissorhands. You know, it feels like this 1950s world. There's so many 1950s references. And then that, you know, Anthony Michael Hall has a answering machine and a VCR and all this kind of modern electronics. It was like, it kind of took you out of the story a little bit because there were these touches of modernity throughout. But then it's like, okay, I can still believe that there is this world where this stuff exists. And I could believe that there was this kind of cabin boy world where there is the school for the fancy lads and all of this stuff going on. And there are pirates and, you know, these kind of salty dogs out on the seas and giants and, you know, ice monsters and all this kind of stuff. I bought into the whole package. But I don't know if it was the critics kind of couldn't get past Elliot's character and his the way that he was, you know, kind of dim-witted, but also very, you know, like his whole thing is trying to talk everybody into, you know, getting him into Hawaii and, you know, let's turn around the boat and everything. And that's kind of what gets him into trouble is he finally gets Andy Richter to, you know, allegedly put him on the right path to Hawaii. But I don't know if that's what it was. It just he turned people off because you're right. Like I can see this. You know, there were other movies that, you know, did the same kind of stuff that weren't as, you know, lambasted by people. I don't know if it was that the 90s were more cynical or what it was. But, you know, this was up there with like, you know, like a Yellowbeard or Eric the Viking or these kind of movies where it was like this mix of fantasy and adventure and, you know, like sometimes being like a kid's movie, but then also having very adult moments, maybe that confused them as well.
Well, I mean, it's definitely not a kid's film. And I think one thing that's interesting about the character that Chris Elliott has in the film is that if you know him from Get a Life or you know him from Letterman, he always has this thing, like we were talking about, like characters that have this ego to them. Like they have this, like in here, it's developed as snobbery, but just sort of this ego to them that just sort of just drips off. And they're also a little like dim-witted and sarcastic against people. And in here, what's interesting is that you get that character. And then eventually by the end, he's kind of come out of it. Like he's kind of evolved his thinking, you know, and how he treats people and all this stuff. So I actually think you get a pretty good dynamic of the character, a pretty good range of the character and how he changes and how he interacts with people. So I think that maybe some of the humor, as you were saying, Mike, watching it with your folks was a bit of a turnoff because people are like, oh, you know, I don't know if I should laugh at this because he's, you know, making fun of people in such a way.
I got to say, Rob, that you probably have the right attitude about this movie. I actually got to admit, this is horrible, but it's actually ruined relationships where I just didn't see like girlfriend the same way after she said she didn't like the movie. Like she couldn't get into it. And I realize that's insane and that's stupid, but actually my love of this movie is ruined relationship. It's ruined friendships. It's ruined so much because I just could not see the other people not liking this movie. So that's bad on my end. That's horrible.
I can kind of understand that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if there are movies that you love, and I know that you love this one, Mr. Sullivan, I can see where, you know, if people just don't get it, that maybe, you know, they don't get you either.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, that's just going to give me an excuse to be just even more horrible. Don't do that.
Kind of talking about test films. I don't know if you happen to have a personal test film, but when we did my vampire film years ago, there's a line in the script that talks about Raising Arizona. And it's sort of a similar thing. Like the character is like, well, you know, if you can't enjoy Raising Arizona, you're bound to find some deeper flaws, you know, within your personality. And it almost sounds like this is it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. I don't know. I do the same thing with Tim and Eric too. You know, that's probably worse because I know even more people dislike Tim and Eric. So, yeah, I do with a lot of comedies. I test a lot of people. Like, Andy Kaufman's like a decent barometer with me, too. I use that with people.
But see, it's good that you bring up Tim and Eric because that's the thing I wanted to talk about with Cabin Boy.
Oh, great.
And really with Chris Elliott is that I think in a lot of ways, if it wasn't for Chris Elliott doing the bits he was doing on Late Night and then Get a Life and then Cabin Boy and things like this, that you wouldn't have a Tim and Eric. You wouldn't have like Mr. Show. You wouldn't have, you know, that kind of sensibility and humor, which is, you know, kind of has developed where it's a little more mainstream now. Like, people are willing to accept these sort of absurdist tangents within comedy and enjoy it. But when he was doing it, it was really kind of, you know, breaking ground and pissing people off.
You know, it's funny. I've said that for years, like how like Adam Resnick and Chris Elliott were like sort of a architects for like modern independent. I don't know. Alternative. Maybe that. But like they were like sort of the architects for things like Adult Swim, you know, and what you just said. I mean, to me, like Adam Resnick's kind of like the Ub Iwerks of comedy, where he's this very important figure that people seem to overlook constantly. You know, he's introduced so much, he's developed so much, and he's like so, he's going to listen to this, right? He's probably going to feel terrible. But I think he's like wrongly unappreciated.
No, I totally get that. And like stuff like Death to Smoochie, it's like, why was that one, again, kind of just thrown out there and just, you know, like the critics just kind of backed their car over it, and they just did not seem to get where he was coming from with that. And it's to me, it's just this kind of, he has opened so many doors, and then he just is just so unappreciated. He's kind of like, you know, the Orson Welles of comedy. You know, he's just tried pushing the envelope so much. We're doing a thing about Magnificent Ambersons in a couple weeks, and one of the lines I read about Orson Welles is, you know, he was 25 years ahead of his time, but people really like folks that are about 6 seconds ahead of their time, so that, you know, there's not that much room to catch up.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think, I mean, a lot of people too, like George Meyer, you know, a lot of Letterman writers, and then Resnick was a Letterman writer, and these guys are just so important. I think to a certain degree, they're just horribly ignored, you know, and I think that's a real shame. It's a real shame.
And that was the thing too, like you brought up watching Get a Life, and at the time when you first saw it, you couldn't relate to it. It kind of bothered you. I remember seeing it and thought it was just amazing. Like, I was like 10 or 12 at the time, and I was just blown away by it. And it would come on at 1 a.m. It used to get preempted a lot in Detroit. And I would set the VCR and tape it, and I just treasured those episodes of Get a Life. And for years, I was so upset that they never put out both seasons on DVD. And finally, they did about a year ago. Because there was only like, you could only get like scattered episodes. There were like 2 or 3 DVDs that were out. There was like 2 or 3 episodes on each. And it was like, that's okay. But as you'll hear in the interview, while they're happy, I guess, that it's out there, they're not really happy that it's out there at the same time. So, but when I look at the stuff, like I said, when I look at the stuff that Chris Elliott was doing throughout his career and still really continues to do, I think that if it wasn't for him, like I said, no Tim and Eric, no Mr. Show, no like the stuff that Zach Galifianakis can get away with, it just seems that all of that stuff is connected back to what he was doing, like first started out like 30 years ago. And Letterman really allowed that kind of experimentation. And I think even Letterman's own sensibility of humor, like you were talking about with the Oscars, is also in that way, where one thing I noticed about Letterman, like you were talking about that Oprah Uma thing, is that the first time he does it, it's funny. By the time he gets to the 6th time, no one gets to laugh anymore. And then when he brings it back, people will laugh again. There's almost this, do it, it's funny, then keep doing it, it's not funny anymore. And then at some point, it breaks again and becomes funny, just because it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think he was probably the first guy to introduce that concept. The whole, like, just, like, overusing until it's unfunny and then bringing it back. Was he the first guy to do that?
He's the first that I can think of in terms of, you know, TV to do that kind of stuff. I mean, just beating something to death until it's funny again. Most of the time, once it dies, people give up and they don't bring it up anymore.
Yeah, Mike, you mentioned Andy Kaufman, and I think that, you know, there's definitely a pretty clear line going on with Kaufman and Letterman and Elliott's comedy, where it is this kind of like discomfort that you feel, because like when you're watching Kaufman as, you know, the foreign man character and stuff, you're kind of laughing at him as well as laughing with him, you know, and just that whole idea of like, why is this guy doing what he's doing? And that whole idea that he never breaks character whatsoever. And that's one of the things that I like about Elliott, is just that he holds on to those characters. And like you were saying, Rob, that kind of like, especially when he comes out as those like egomaniac kind of characters, which I love, you know, talking about absurdist kind of stuff. I love that he was part of that he did the parody of Rocket Man, you know, just that deadpan and talk about ego, you know, to do that, that parody.
She packed my bags last night. Pre-flight. 0 hour. I don't know. I think it was about 9 a.m. I didn't look at my watch. And I'm going to be high. As a kite. By then. Oh, I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife, too.
Just such an obscure reference at that point. You know, this is before YouTube and people, you know, knowing what he was referencing.
He had to be the first that did that. He had to be.
Yeah. You know, and now it's like, you know, you see that kind of stuff being parodied and thrown out there to the winds on Family Guy all the time. You know, like these really, you know, quirky references and these characters that are, you know, make you uncomfortable and stuff. But yeah, I think that definitely those guys were in the vanguard when it came to that stuff. And I loved what you guys were saying as far as that whole, like, beating the joke into the ground thing that Letterman does, because that is just, it's freaking priceless. And there is that moment where it does become funny. And yeah, I wish I knew who was that person, if it was Letterman, or who it was that, who came up with that whole idea of, like, you know, you just beat the joke into the ground. It's so not funny, or it starts off not funny and then finally manages to come back through that absurdism and through that repetition. I love that kind of stuff.
All right, let's take a break and hear an interview with Chris Elliott and Adam Resnick as they talk about working together on Letterman, through Cabin Boy, and beyond.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that fucking burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst fucking piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
GGTMC. Live. For you. Fresh, yeah. Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to the trash since 1977.
You know, I was looking for a little excitement, but I was worried about privacy. And then I found out about Vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women, and men, and couples. They have helpful suggestions and information on how to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has never played around with your privacy. While other.coms make their money by selling your information, Vibrators.com never has and never will. And when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order. That's Vibrators.com. Get a little excitement in your life.
Excuse me, what are you doing? Are you looking for porn again?
No.
Well, what is that I see?
It's not porn. It's the badassboobsandbodycounts.com website. I happen to be looking at the reviews in the boobs section of the site.
They have a section of the site dedicated to boobs?
Yes, they do. They cover exploitation films in the boobs category, action films in the badass category, and horror in the body counts category.
What's that other option? BB and BC podcast?
If you're not into reading the reviews, you can listen to them via the web on your mobile device through iTunes, and they cover the same types of films, lesser known action, exploitation, and horror cinema. So yeah, to answer your question, I wasn't cruising porn.
That's too bad.
What's too bad?
That you weren't cruising for porn.
Why?
Because I was feeling kind of horny.
Ooh, wait, get back here. Hey, get back here.
Do-si-do.
Both of you guys got your start on Late Night with David Letterman, and is that originally how you met? And what do you remember about sort of the early days of working together on the show?
I guess I started a few months before Adam. Maybe, was it a year before you came?
No, I think it's more like, it might have been 2 or 3 years.
Oh, really?
You were there at 82, right?
I was there right from the start. I guess, you and I think pretty much hit it off right away. I had been working a lot with Matt Wickline and Sandy Frank. I guess I was a writer by the time you were hired, right?
You were a writer.
I had done stuff on the show like the guy under the seats, and I had done these running characters, I remember you telling me that you used to. You watched the show at home, and you thought I was probably some sort of Michael O'Donohue kind of prick kind of guy in real life, and you had no idea what I was really like. And then I guess you were surprised at my meek demeanor when we met each other.
Your character was so believable that I thought, I loved it. It was all the stuff you did was so funny, but I just thought, well, that's really the guy. I didn't even take it as a performance, I don't think.
It was easy to see how funny Adam was right from the start, and Dave did as well. I mean, Adam sort of was writing sort of jokes under the table for Dave before he became a writer, and was going out on remotes and doing a lot of the stuff that actually I did, because I started on the show as a production assistant before they made me a writer, and sort of did the same thing, sort of,
I kind of followed your template. Like, you're the one who, showed me what to do and how to, and I mean, fortunately, Dave liked my stuff and you liked my stuff, so it was...
We hit it off, and we're from completely different, backgrounds. Adam was raised in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I was raised in New York City, but we have just all our reference points are the same, and a lot of our experiences, childhood experiences, are similar. Our hatred of school, all sorts of things that we had in common, and movies too. The same kind of movies sort of appealed to both of us, and
neither of us could spell.
Well, you actually went. Did some college work, but I skipped that.
Well, Harrisburg Area Community College.
Well, kid, I couldn't get in. I tried. It just seemed like we were, just sort of brothers from another planet or something. When we met each other, it seemed like. We were supposed to meet each other, and Adam immediately was giving me ideas and writing stuff for me, and he was luckily made a writer. I don't know how far into you working there they made you a writer, and then we started working together and never looked back.
Well, actually, we look somewhat back when it's not too painful, but that wouldn't be the Dave years. Those were the great years.
No, those were really great years.
Yeah.
Were there any bits during that time, do you remember, that you worked on together, and then sort of thinking out from that, going, you know, that was when you sort of cemented this sort of working relationship that you guys ended up having for about, you know, at least another decade plus?
Even before Adam was a writer, he was adding jokes to my pieces and giving me ideas for things. You know, one of the early things we worked on was, you know, a Martin Downey Jr. Impersonation, which was, you know, Adam and I both were fans of that show and enjoyed watching it and thought, you know, it would be a perfect thing to do for Dave. And
SNL got a hold of it. So
Fast. There was always that sort of thing hanging over me, whatever I did at Letterman, because SNL was always quick to jump on things. So, you know, if something happened early in the week, I would try to get something on by Wednesday so that I could beat Saturday Night Live to doing it. And Martin Downey Jr. was something that, you know, I think I beat John Lovitz out doing that on Dave. We also like doing like sort of obscure things. There was this guy in New York City on local television, you know, public access. And his name was John Wolowich, and he was a nightclub singer from, you know, a bygone era, and he was now in his, you know, early... He was a cabaret guy, and, you know, he sat at a piano, and he was bald, and he had big, you know, horn-rimmed glasses, you know, loved Jerome Kern, and would take, you know, requests, and people would call in and ask things, and he would go, oh, that's a Jerome Kern song, oh, I know that one, and he'd play, you know, at the piano. I think he had a, you know, picture of Betty Davis on his piano, and a little cup and a hand every now and then would come in and put a dollar bill in his glass on the piano, and he'd say thank you. And Adam and I would watch that show, and I remember, I don't know how we did this, but we called each other. We were on like some sort of party line like this, but we also called John Wolowich. So we would
like
call
a three-way call or something. Yeah, right.
Yeah, we would call him and make our requests. And he'd start singing, and then you and I would just talk about business. We'd talk about, like, working with Letterman.
We would literally forget about, like, the our fun was over, and it was just like, you know.
Right. Stuff like, and Wolowich was just be, like, playing and just going, well, I don't know what they're talking about. It seems like it's a full moon tonight, folks. And he'd go on and play. And then eventually we worked that into a bit on Letterman, where I played sort of Johnny... Grant.
Johnny Grant.
That's the name of my guy. But I guess, I mean, obviously the signature piece that Adam and I worked on together that, you know, sort of, I think probably solidified it was Brando, which we had, you know, we both sort of fell on that at the same time. Marlon Brando had not been, you know, in the public eye for a while, and we both were sitting around one day just imagining what he would be like now, and it sort of developed into the idea that he was just this kind of insane homeless guy that would show up and bug Dave from time to time and walk on the show.
And it turned out that was really the Marlon Brando that everyone sort of knew later. Like, it's pretty close to what he was. You know,
Yeah.
So you guys were obviously both part of the team that put together Get a Life. Do you remember how that came together? And then what did Fox expect, and then how is it so different than what I guess maybe they expected?
Well, it was, you know, I had been doing a lot of stuff on the show, and it, you know, Fox sort of approached me and wanted, you know, me to develop something for them. And at the time, I remember them actually, you know, saying they were looking for the new Cosby show. And, you know, I was baffled by that they would come to me for that kind of thing. But I think they were looking for a family show with me as the head of the family, and they did get a kind of a family show. I mean, it is, you know, there is a family in that show, but I'm not sure it had exactly the, I don't know, the emotional, you know, feel that a Cosby show had, or family ties kind of show, which I think is what they were looking for.
The things that make sense about going to you for a family show is they were sort of branding themselves as like an edgier kind of network, and you know, there's Simpsons and Married with Children and those kinds of shows, and which were different for the time. So it seems you, of all people, they were like, okay, we want you to be more of an anchor. You know, we want you.
Well, I think I came, you know, it was sort of like the wrong, it was a timing thing. I think they were possibly wanting to change their image, or were worried that their image was going to be too narrow as that kind of network, and they wanted to be more like NBC and ABC and CBS as opposed to their own selves. And there was, you know, it was a time when they're, you know, obviously internet wasn't around, and you know, there weren't a lot of other cable outlets yet, you know, and places to, you know, for people to do unusual things. So I think they were hoping they were eventually just going to be more mainstream than what they had started out as, and I was going to be there. The guy who was going to lead them into mainstream, middle-of-the-road TV. But at any rate, I knew I wanted to do something different, and I knew I wanted to work with Adam, and that Adam, you know, was going to write it with me. They, you know, Fox wanted me to bring in somebody who would, you know, run the show, an executive producer, and I, you know, met with a number of people and picked Dave Merkin, who was, you know, a guy who... yeah, had known all my stuff and had the same sensibility as us. And, you know, we pitched a show to Fox that was essentially, you know, kind of a grown-up Dennis the Menace. And it was, you know, I guess the spin I put on it was that it was kind of like Big, like, you know, Tom Hanks' movie. It was like a, you know, a kid in an adult body, you know, that it would be heartwarming and all that. And, you know, some of that is true. You know, what we wrote, and, you know, Adam and I went back to New York and wrote the pilot and then brought it out. And then Dave came on, and he was originally going to shepherd it through for us and then stayed on.
Dave Merkin.
Stayed on, yeah, through the pilot and when the show was picked up, the series. You know, what we ended up doing, the three of us, was, you know, a creation that was really completely different than what Fox wanted. And, you know, they were, they put it on the air, but they were baffled by it every week. You know, at the table reads, they were baffled by it. And they would, you know, give us lots of notes. You know, we would find tricky ways of putting their notes in the shows and then, you know, editing them out and... or making them into jokes in some way, so that their note really was not accomplished. And I don't know, after a season and a half of that, I think they were fed up and they said, okay, enough is enough. And that was that. But I think we did some great work there, and I think it was, when I look back on it now and I see the amount of response that people nowadays have towards that show, or you know, I guess it was somewhat groundbreaking, you know, even though, you know, it did not feel that at the time. It felt like, you know, we were, you know, kind of in the dark about how people felt about it. I certainly didn't know that people were enjoying it at the time.
I mean, I don't know, I personally felt miserable through most of Get a Life because it was just too much, you know, I felt in some ways that, you know,
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.